Hello, 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 everybody, and welcome to a horribly nerdy podcast. The podcast that's so bad, horrible, is in its name. And I do apologize if you're going to hear, like, tapping or stuff like that. That's just me, you know, scrolling through my phone because the script is on my phone. I still don't have a computer or a laptop to do this, so again, it's all done from my smartphone, which is why it's a horrible, horrible podcast. Anyways, I digress. Anyways, I'm happy to be back. I'm happy to be doing this, and today especially, because we're going to be delving into some splatterpunk and extreme horror novels. Now, these are not for the easily offended or for those with a weak stomach. Please read these at your own discretion. I will give you trigger warnings at the very end, just to, you know, during my review, just so you know what's coming up. And, yeah, some of these, like this first one I'm going to talk about is, it's really, really, really fucked up. Actually, you know what? What I'll do is I'll give you the trigger warnings before we go into it, and then I'll give you, like, a quick synopsis and my review of the story. Yeah, it's crazy. Like, this is a really, like, this is the first story I'm fairly new to extreme horror and splatterpunk. I've been enjoying it. Because it's different. It's a different genre. Like, it's pretty hardcore. Like, you have to have a strong constitution in order to kind of get through it. Like, there's some pretty messed up stuff. And the first one we're going to be talking about, this one messed me up. And we're going to be talking about The Slob, written by Aaron Beauregard. Trigger warning, this story has rape, molestation, extreme sexual content, extreme violence, and a ton of gore. So, yeah, it's pretty nasty. Some stains don't come out. Raised in a household that was so filthy it was stomach-spilling, Vera has become a neat freak. Her obsession with cleanliness sprouts the concept that her skills can be put to use in a unique way. In an effort to generate some income for her and her disabled husband Daniel, just prior to the birth of their first child, she takes aim at the booming door-to-door sales business of the late 80s. All is going very well until she arrives at the steps of a house she'll wish she never had. The steps of an evil that brings back the ghastly memories she so desperately tried to wash away. Nothing will prepare you... Goddamn. Nothing will prepare you for the nastiness, disorder, and uncleansable horror brought forth by The Slob. I had to take a shower after reading this because it was messed up. This was the first thing I had ever read by Aaron Beauregard, and it sets the stage for what I would come to read in his other stories and novels, for sure. It was a hard read. It was disturbing, disgusting, horrific, vomit-inducing, and extreme. Again, I had only recently gotten to extreme horror when I read this, and boy, it hit me hard. When I say I enjoyed this book, I mean I enjoyed the style of writing and had to give respect to the author for going there. The atrocities that are committed to people in this story are stomach-churning. I could not put this book down, though. I had to get to the end and see how things played out. You truly feel for our protagonist and truly, truly hate our antagonist. The penultimate conclusion of the story I totally did not see coming, and I give this 4 vacuums out of 5. Next, we're going to be talking about Porn by Matt Shaw. Yeah, I'm not talking about porn in general. This story is actually called Porn. Trigger warning, graphic sexual violence and graphic violence. Porn tells the tragic tale of Victoria Sheldon, a young lady who wanted nothing more than to become an actress. With times being hard, Victoria finds herself in the world of adult movie industry, where she soon carves a name for herself. Soon the offers are flowing in, as is the money, and as she becomes more and more popular amongst the producers. But then she meets him, a man with an offer she can't refuse, and a man who has other ideas about how pornographic films should be filmed. A man catering for a much, much darker audience. This was a very interesting read, with a twist I totally did not see coming. A revenge tale for all revenge tales. I give this one 4.5 porn actresses out of 5. I don't want to really delve into too much. It's a relatively short read, and going into it a little too much, there's a ton of spoilers, but boy, you're rooting for this our protagonist, Victoria. You're all on her side, and when that twist comes, you'll see what I mean if you decide to read the story. Another one by Matt Shaw, Rotting Dead Fucks. Okay, this one, mild spoilers here, literally starts out with necrophilia. Just so you know. Trigger warning, necrophilia, graphic violence, graphic sexual violence, and child molestation. Putting it out there, this one was fucked up, didn't see it coming, and Jesus Christ, this really, it hit me hard. Like, this was messed up, but let's just get into it. One psychopath, one doctor, one father, and a fuckload of rotting dead fucks, and one hell of a couple days. Told through the eyes of the three main characters trying to survive the first few days of an unknown outbreak, only one thing is guaranteed. This is Matt Shaw at his darkest and most depraved. This was a short read, had all the gore I was looking for, plus a few twists and turns that are unnerving, unsettling, and revolting. This one had me gagging by the end of it. Of course, I have to give it 4 rotting dead fucks out of 5. The three main characters, the two of them you feel for, like, for everything they're going through, everything that's happening, you most certainly feel for everything they're going through. And then the one main character, you are so just, you hate him by the end of this. That's all I'm going to say. That's all I'm going to say on this one. We, of course, will have more and more gross-out stories next week. I have more extreme horror to talk about. And pretty much just the genre of gross-out itself. It's something that I want to talk about more. I don't think it gets talked about enough. It's definitely an interesting style of stories and novels and stuff. I have been enjoying it. There have been some really, really, really fucked up stuff. And there's been some stuff that really, like, I thought it was amazing. Like, for them to come out and do all this, great. Honestly, like, holy shit. Like, for extreme horror, like, it was just something, a category I never thought that, like, I like horror and I don't mind it, like, Terrifier, like, let's just say, like, Terrifier and Terrifier 2, those are very, very gory movies. If you can't handle anything like that, then you shouldn't be reading these stories. But if you enjoy stuff like that, and I don't mean enjoy, like, oh, yeah, look at all the... you have to have, like, a love for practical effects and for a director or a writer or an actor to go there. That's what you have to, like, really respect. And Matt Shaw and Aaron Beauregard, and even more that we'll be talking about next week, they have no problem going there. Like, to the distance. Yeah, anyways, I'm going to move on. So now, let's kind of go from gross out and grossness and extreme horror to some more paranormal stuff. And today I want to talk about a book that I read, and I'm going to kind of read some excerpts from this book. It was written, it's written by Zachary Knowles, who went around and interviewed a bunch of law enforcement officers and got their ghost stories, their weird encounters on the job, stuff like that. So this is called Real Police Ghost Stories, True Tales of the Paranormal as Told by Cops and Other Law Enforcement Officials. Again, this is written by Zachary Knowles. And here are a few excerpts from that book that I found creepy and interesting. The first story comes from my mouth is very, very dry and I don't have access to water at the moment, so please excuse me. The first story comes from a call-out in rural Illinois. A police officer and his partner were working the night shift, usually a quiet affair, only dealing with the occasional loud drunk and speeding car. The call came in saying there was a suspected break-in at the local morgue. A bit of an odd place to break in, admittedly, but there are a good number of chemicals inside which may be an interest to drug addicts. The officers took the call and headed to the morgue to investigate. Upon arrival, they found the custodian waiting outside for them, looking a little shaken. He told the officers he was mopping the floors when he saw something move in his peripheral vision. When he looked up, he saw someone run across the hallway from one side to the other and disappear into the room. Unfortunately, he could not give a good description of the person due to the fact that he had turned the lights off as he cleaned, but still, he was sure he saw someone, and being alone and unarmed, he decided discretion was the better part of valor and called the police. The two officers figured it might have been some kids breaking in for the fun of it, or the custodian might have been seeing things, but the man was certain enough about what he saw to convince the officers to actually check it out. They started by verbally warning anyone that it was inside the building to show themselves. They did not receive an answer, other than their voices echoing back at them. The officers, along with the custodian, did a sweep of the building by walking the central corridor, hands on guns, and checking each side of the room as they came across them. Most were labs for analysis, some storage for tools or administrative files. As they moved about, they turned on the lights to ensure they did not forego anyone hiding. One officer opened a door to a blackened room and fumbled to find the light switch. What he found was an empty room for relatives of the deceased. He swept the room quickly, checking every place a person could hide. As he was doing so, he was suddenly startled when his partner shouted, "Hey, stop, turn around." The officer turned to see his partner with his gun raised toward the end of the left corridor. He was surprised. The officer turned to see his partner with his gun raised towards the end of the corridor. "She went around the corner," he said, indicating the left-hand route at the end of the corridor. "That's way a dead end, and no escape from there," the custodian explained. Knowing that they had the intruder cornered, the officers... Why am I like... Jesus, I'm stumbling on words today. I apologize profusely. Knowing they had the intruder cornered, the officers advanced down the corridor, calling out to the woman to reassure her she would be safe if she just came out and surrendered. The first officer went to the end of the corridor and peered around the corner to see the woman standing at the end. The lights were still off in that part of the building. The lights were still off in the part of the building, allowing him to have a rough image of her and her long, fair hair. Wanting to see if he could talk to her to convince her to leave with him quietly, he stepped out from behind the corridor. As soon as she saw him, however, she hauled open a big gray door behind her and ran through it, slamming the door behind her. The officer ran up to the door, but found it was locked. Banging on it for a little while, he called out to the woman to show herself, but of course, there was no response. His partner and the custodian came up to him, and he explained the situation, which seemed to concern the custodian. Apparently, the door couldn't be locked from the inside. The custodian unlocked it, and the two officers headed inside, guns raised. Shining their flashlights around the room, they revealed everything except the woman they were trying to find. The place was eerie in their light, and one officer felt it was strangely cold, even for a morgue. The custodian came in behind them, flicked the lights on, filling the room with light. It was largely empty, some workspaces along the sides, equipment against one wall, and two gurneys for bodies in the middle of the room. One gurney was covered with a sheet, a body shape underneath it. It would have been a clever hiding place if the room had been more regularly used, but as it was, the officers knew they had their suspect. As they approached the gurney, they realized something was wrong. There was an unearthly stench emanating from the shape. It wasn't from someone alive or even someone unwashed and sweaty, but rather the smell of rot and death. The officers pulled the sheet off their body, and there was the woman they had been chasing through the building, a toe tag hanging off her foot, stating she had died 4 days earlier. It was a freezing cold November night in New Hampshire, out in the countryside, where the houses thin out amongst the lakes and forests. Sorry, the way this is, like, the way I have it kind of entered in, how should I, like, the spacing of this is messed up, and that's what's keeping it. Sorry. Something. What was I saying? Oh, yeah, the way that this is kind of, like, spaced out, it's tripping me up, so I apologize. I apologize for all the tapping and the moving around on the phone and all that. I really need to just save up money for a laptop or something and really make these better. Let's start over, eh? It was a freezing cold November night in New Hampshire, out in the countryside, where the houses thin out amongst the lakes and the forests. The darkness and cold there aren't like that in the cities. It is a lethal, impenetrable barrier to anyone unprepared to face the conditions, and many have perished when they have underestimated its power. The police received a call about a little girl who'd been seen wandering around on her own near one of the lakes. This was a serious problem, considering the weather was dangerously cold and a child near the water could fall in and drown without anyone finding her again. The lakes around those parts were deep and dark, and once something sunk there was a slim chance it would ever see the light of day again. Every available officer in the area responded out there. Two officers who had children of their own wanted to ensure the girl was found when they were first on the scene. They got to the lake after a long, dark drive. The weather had been threatening snow for a couple of days, and they were hoping it'd hold off until they finished their search. When they arrived, they reported to dispatch and began looking for the girl. There weren't many houses around the lake, and it was pitch black, causing them to be leery as they picked their way through the undergrowth and marshy areas beside the lake. Eventually, they got to a dirt beach with a little clearing where the wind moved. Eventually, they got to a dirt beach with a little clearing where the wind moved the water frequently enough to stop anything taking root there. They searched the area, checking any hollows or dark spots the girl could be hiding, but found nothing. As they searched, they discussed what a little girl could be doing out there in the middle of a winter's night. Could she have gotten lost, possibly? Separating from her family somehow on a walk? Or maybe she was a runaway, though no one had reported a missing child. They were finishing up their search of the beach when the lead officer's partner tapped him on the shoulder and pointed into the water. The officer looked, and there in the water was the little girl. Later, when he was telling the story to other officers who arrived, he told them when he saw her, all the hairs on the back of his neck stood up. She was standing in about ankle-deep water and was wearing an old-fashioned white nightgown that sat just above the surface of the water. The two officers turned to look at each other, knowing something wasn't right about this situation. They radioed into dispatch, stating they found the girl and then approached closer. She didn't respond to their movements, so the lead officer knelt down near the edge of the water and held his arms out to her like he would his own daughter. "I'm a policeman. Come out of the water, honey. It's not safe in there," he had said, beckoning her to come to him. The little girl turned to the officers, her eyes oddly vacant, and started to walk towards the officer. As she did so, another patrol car arrived near the scene, and the officers headed to the bush to see her walking towards the officer. She got just outside of arm's reach of the officer, and then just vanished from one moment to the next. All that remained was a series of small footprints in the mud near him. Four officers from different angles saw this happen. Not one of them can explain what happened, But 2 years later, there was a similar circumstance in which a little girl in a white nightgown was seen at the lake. She vanished as well. And now legend is the little girl haunts the lake. What she wants, or why she is there, no one knows. The police were called to a domestic violence report in a poor inner city area of America known for high amounts of crime, prostitution, human trafficking, and drug-related violence. Neighbors in a residential complex initially phoned in the call as they heard screaming and banging. The police arrived on the scene and found 7 people, mostly from the families who lived in the complex, out on the grass, praying silently. The officers heard the people mumbling on their breath as though they didn't want to disturb someone. When the officers asked what they were doing, one answered, "Praying for our souls." This unsettled the officers and immediately set the tone for what was to come next. Heading into the apartment, they were directed to go to a room where a member of the family was apparently possessed. Skeptical and thinking this was probably a drug-related incident, they went to assess the situation. Reaching the door, they realized there were multiple voices in the room, though they were advised there was only one man screaming at one another in languages neither of the officers recognized. Sensing the situation was outside their expertise, the officer called for backup and EMTs for a potentially serious psychological incident. While awaiting for the backup to arrive, the officers questioned the family about the man. Apparently, he'd been acting oddly for weeks, becoming anxious and agitated over minuscule things and progressively more haggard and pale as if he was ill. About a half an hour before the police arrived, he started screaming he was going to eat his family and would be dragged back to hell because he'd broken the agreement. Next, he started begging the Virgin Mary to save him and then began foaming at the mouth and burning himself with holy candles. The family managed to stop him and move him into another room, but he became more violent to the point where they couldn't control him. A family member said they'd given up when he climbed up onto the walls and out of the ceiling. As the family retold the story, the man continued to scream so piercingly in unknown languages, the walls were shaking. All of the officers involved in the incident were highly trained, experienced, longtime members of the force, but many of the officers were starting to become unglued. One officer even passed a rosary through his fingers to comfort himself, while the rest managed to keep a lid on their fears. When the EMTs and backup arrived, they headed upstairs with the officers to the man's room. They tried the door, but the man locked himself in, forcing the officers to break down the door. They discovered a room completely upturned, almost everything knocked over, and covered in bloody foam from the man's mouth. There was one desk lamp still on and working, casting shadows of strange shapes that seemed to transform when eyed. After the officers were sure no one else was in the room, the EMTs moved in and tried to calm the man down. He was huddled in the corner of the room, hunched up in a squat like an animal over a fresh kill. He was rambling under his breath to an invisible figure. One of the medics said his name and his head poked up, but in the way like a dog does. Just a movement of the head and neck with no self-consciousness of this moment. A couple of the officers put their hands onto their guns at that point, natural reaction, sensing an imminent threat. Disturbed by this, but still trying to remain calm, the medic asked the man how he was feeling. The man smiled and said in Spanish, "God himself will not recognize you when I am done with you." At that point, the officers and medics made a unanimous agreement to take the man into custody quickly, but as they were discussing the situation, the man stood up, breathing heavily. From the scratch marks on his body, it was clear he'd been clawing at himself, and his chest was covered in bloody foam from his mouth. Smiling again, he looked at the rosary the officer had hanging around his chest. "That trinket won't save you," he said as he rushed toward them. Despite just being one man against 6 other people, they had a major fight on their hands. The first officer the man got to tackled him into the ground as the officers jumped into the pile on top and to stop him through sheer weight alone. The man fought wildly, scratching, punching, and struggling like a cornered animal, screaming at them all the while. Eventually, they manage to subdue him, enough for one of the medics to prepare a syringe to sedate him. As the medics were doing this, the lead officer, who was holding the man's arm over his head, made eye contact with the man. The officer began crying out in horror and released his arms, recoiling from the man like he was seeing something truly disturbing. In response, the man stopped struggling, gave a deep belly laugh that made everyone in the room shiver, and said to the officer, "Look closely so you don't forget." The medic managed to get the syringe ready and sedated the man enough for the others to get him onto a back of stretcher and strap him down before taking him out of the ambulance. The officer who made eye contact with the man was white as a sheet and refused to ride in the ambulance, opting to follow in a patrol car behind. Another officer rode in the ambulance with the medics, and as he tells it, he never took his hand off his gun during the entire journey. When they got to the hospital, the officer who made eye contact went to the chapel and pray. Later, when one of his fellow asks him what he saw, he said, "His eyes weren't human. I know what I saw. I've never seen anyone with eyes like that. It was like looking into the eyes of the devil." Rural Wyoming isn't like other country areas. There are often houses 50 or 100 miles away from the nearest civilization, hidden deep in the plains and forests. One night, a police officer and his partner were called out at about 11 p.m. to a house deep in the countryside for reported suspicious activity. That far out in the countryside, a suspicious activity could mean anything from a car sitting in a field to a UFO sighting. Not knowing what to expect, the officers headed out. When they arrived, the family living in the home told the officer they were hearing peculiar screaming coming from the direction of a creek near their property. The officers waited a short while on the porch with the family, and sure enough, they too heard the scream coming from a few hundred yards away in the darkness. It was an incredibly strange sound, like a woman in distress, but higher pitched. It lasted about 10 to 15 seconds and repeated every few minutes. It was strange enough for the officers, both experienced outdoorsmen, to be sure it was not an animal around the area that could make such a sound, nor anything else they've ever heard of. They instructed the family to stay in the house, and they went to investigate. The officers set off towards where they heard the noise coming from, pushing through dark pine woods, while their flashlight shadows danced and created disturbing shapes at the corners of their eyes. As they walked, the lead officer tried to work out what it was they were hearing. In his mind, there were two options for what was causing the noise. Either an animal sound they'd never heard of, possible but unlikely, or a woman being murdered or mutilated in the creek bed. Equally as unlikely, but far more serious. They heard the scream twice more as they approached, but when they reached a small, muddy stream passing through the creek, the screaming stopped. Whoever was making the noises was still alive, the officer... Oh, I'm sorry. Hoping whoever was making the noise was still alive, the officer began to shout for anyone who could hear them come towards their voices, since it was safe. The only response was the sound of the water and the wind sighing through the trees. They waited 10 minutes and didn't hear anything else and figured it must have been an animal that scurried away and was scared. Suddenly, the scream came again. But this time, it came from the direction the officers had just come from, back into the small patch of woods they'd passed through. Turning and heading back there, they got about halfway back to the house when the scream came again, right beside them. By that point, the officers had trepidations and cast their light around to see who or what was making that noise, but they did not see anything. No eyes shining in the darkness, no rustling of bushes or glimpses of something running off, just silence and darkness. The scream came again back towards the creek, and this time lasted longer and louder than ever before, making their ears ring. The lead officer would later describe it as sounding almost malignant, as though it wanted him to leave. The two officers decided to retreat back to the house at that point as the hair rose on their arms and neck. Whatever it was, the final scream convinced them they didn't want to find out. At the foot What? Where did I get that from? At the house, they told the family to call again if they heard anything else and ran out of the place as quickly as possible. The lead officer later described the utter silence of the area and how unusual it was, considering during Wyoming summers. Especially in wet areas, there are always insects and frogs making a racket. But during the whole time the officers were searching it, it was as silent as a grave. Not all police officers work on the streets of cities. Some spend their time making sure law and order are maintained on military bases as well. Much like in the cities, the night shift for military police is usually a quieter time, especially during the winter months. Most bases have alarm buildings linked to a central console. If an alarm is tripped, an MP will check all doors to ensure they're locked. If not, the building will be secured, and officers will check for intruders or a malfunction. This story begins much like any other on a quiet night without anything needing attention. One MP and his partner were on patrol about midnight when an alarm was tripped in the elementary school. As many servicemen and women also have families, the military also has schools on the base. The partners went to check on the building and found all doors closed and no sign of anyone around. They called in to report the building secured and carried on. About 20 minutes later, they received another call concerning another alarm at the school. The officers headed back to the school and once again did a full check. This time, though, there was a door open leading into a boiler room. Inside was dark and dank, full of cobwebs and reeking of diesel fuel from the pipes leading to the boiler. The room wasn't particularly large, and the officers searched it top to bottom, even checking the vents and cupboards in case someone was hiding in there. Figuring someone must have forgotten to lock it, they secured the room, locked the door properly, and headed on their way again. Another half hour later, another call arrived about the alarm. Once again, they headed back to the school. Feeling increasingly hoodwinked, they checked all the doors, found them all to be locked, including the boiler room they'd previously checked. The dorms were alarmed, but if someone yanked hard enough, that alarm would go off. In the past, teenagers on base had been known to do it if they were particularly bored, despite the risk. I was doing so well. Despite the risk of serious reprimands if caught. To test their theory, the two officers sat on opposite sides of the school and waited to see if anyone approached. There was no activity for a long time, including light sounds or movement, but just as the officers were about to leave, they received a call alarm. They received a call about another alarm being set off inside school this time. Wanting to put a stop to the vexation, they called the central desk and asked for the building custodian to join them to do an internal sweep of the school. At this point, it was about 3 a.m. and the officers were becoming tired and irritable. The custodian showed up and the three of them began walking through the school, checking classrooms, cupboards, and maintenance room. The school was designed to accommodate all the children on the base and had been built in the early 60s, meaning it was designed with winding corridors and numerous offshoots, making the search process slow and laborious. It also had generations of children pass through it on their way to bigger and better things. During the sweep, they didn't bother to turn on any lights as they had powerful flashlights. But it did mean they were walking through an empty school in the pitch dark. One of the military officers described it as being an incredibly eerie experience. As they were nearing the end of their sweep, they noticed one of the maintenance rooms with its door open and a light on inside. They were supposed to be the only three people in the building, and they had not been in that room yet. The police and custodian all confirmed that they did not see the light on earlier or anyone enter the room. It's important to note that the maintenance rooms were small, nothing more than a large closet, with nowhere to hide once inside. They walked down towards the room, sure they finally caught their prankster, but when they looked in, no one was there. The only thing inside were a few brooms and a couple of boxes of spare desk parts. However, on the middle of the floor was a single wet footprint, the size of a child's foot, as though he or she had run through a puddle and continued through the room, tracking the water with them. There was no water on the floor or anywhere else nearby, and the footprint was facing a wall, as though whoever made it stepped through the wall. Each man involved described feeling chills ascend their spine. The men stated they were the only three people in the building, and no one ever reported a missing child. Everything was locked as they had checked the rest of the building in a 3-hour deep search. No one entered and no one left. So where did the footprint come from? To this day, nobody knows. The north of England was once a major industrial center, but the change in economic focus in the 70s and 80s altered the once prosperous industrial towns and gutted them. Now, there are only the broken down shells of farmhouses, mines, manufacturing plants, and others littering the landscape, a testament to the changing times. As a result, many people moved out of these towns to the big cities, leaving quiet, rundown places. Working as a police officer in these areas can be a dull affair, especially sometimes at night. Aside from the occasional drunk, it's rare to have any calls to investigate at all. When the night is quiet, officers often park in a favorite haunt to pass the time, which is exactly what the officers in this story did, except they got more than they bargained for. The officers weren't just work partners, but were also good friends. They had the same taste in music and the same quirky love of animals and astronomy, which made being put on the night shift together a blast for them. It had been a slow night, with no calls at all by 2 a.m., so the officers decided to drive to a remote spot for stargazing and watching nature. At that time of night, it wasn't uncommon to see animals like deer, foxes, hedgehogs, and other creatures usually timid of humans. The officers were chatting away. The officers were chatting away, sharing a thermos of coffee, and just trying to decide whether Jupiter or Mars were in the night sky when one of them noticed a flickering light in a window of one of the abandoned farmhouses. It was a common enough occurrence for teenagers to wander through the desolated farmhouses, so the officers didn't think much of it, but knew they'd have to move them on from being in there, especially if they had candles lit. They drove up to the nearby farmhouse, coasting so the engine noise didn't alert anyone to their arrival. Turning off the car, they could see candlelight through one of the broken windows, as well as hearing low whispering. Thinking they had the kids cornered, the officers got out of the car and approached the broken window to peer in. Oddly enough, instead of a group of teens, the officers discovered not a soul in the room, but rather a lone candle sitting in the middle of the room surrounded by newspaper and books, all within a chalk circle drawn on the floor. Beyond the visual concerns, the officer could also hear whispers from someone in the house. They decided to climb through the broken window to look around, hoping to come across whoever was there. The room was dusty with long abandonment. Their footsteps showed clearly in the thick layer of the grime on the floor. The walls were covered in graffiti, the floorboards were splintered, and the musty, rotten smell of abandonment lingered throughout the place. Out of curiosity, one of the officers picked up a newspaper on the floor and found it was from the 1930s. So were all the others. The books beside the newspaper were journals full of scrawling, foul handwriting about a man and the author's hatred for this man, including how the author planned to murder the man if he did not get out of his head. Feeling uncomfortable with the text, the officer called for his partner's attention, but she had an unsettling discovery on her own. The officer had noticed the unique pattern wallpaper, a flowing, lined fashion that both author The officer had noticed the unique pattern wallpaper, a flowing line fashion that both officers found oddly hypnotic. As the female officer closely approached the wall, she recoiled from it sharply. She realized the pattern wasn't a pattern at all, but rather scribbled writings. The phrase, "Get out of my head, Simon, I'll kill us both," was inscribed repeatedly along all four walls of the room. Feeling properly frightened and disturbed, and still hearing the whispering, they realized they stumbled onto someone potentially both mentally ill and incredibly dangerous. One of the officers shouted a warning, his voice echoing in the big old farmhouse. As soon as he shouted, there was a sudden thump and a draw of breath, like someone in the next room was frightened by the officer's voice, before the hammer of running feet, heavy breathing, and breaking glass could be heard. The officers ran through the house to where the noise came from.
and saw a dark figure running through the long grass of the field beside the house. Vaulting themselves out of the newly broken window, they chased the figure, their torches shining on the back of a suspect as not to lose him or her. The figure led them out into the waist-high field of grass, running faster than either officer could believe. Suddenly, the figure dropped to the ground and disappeared into the grass. Thinking the person must have tripped on a rut in the ground or something similar, the officers ran up to the last spot they saw the figure, expecting to find someone on the ground and ready for a potential fight. Instead, there was no one there. There was a clear trail of trampled grass from the figure's running up to that point, a patch of crushed grass where he or she went down, but then nothing. The grass near the patch was undisturbed, and the officers would have noticed the suspect double back as they were close behind the figure when he or she dropped. Convinced they somehow missed the suspect escaping as they approached, the officers called in the canine unit to help them track the suspect. First, it went well. The dog picked up a strong scent and led them down the path the suspect had taken, pulling at its harness eagerly. When the dog reached the flattened patch where the suspect disappeared, instead of following the scent to the figure, the dog sat in the spot, whimpering, unable to go further. No amount of cajoling or persuasion would get the dog to move, so the canine officer decided the dog had assisted him as possible. Disturbed by their experiences, the two original officers decided... I'm going too fast. Disturbed by their experiences, the two original officers decided to do a sweep of the house again, just in case. Upon going back into the room they first climbed into, they discovered something that sent chills up their spines and made them leave the house without any further investigations. What they found was the candle, newspaper, and books were all gone. Despite the dust covering the floor, there were still only the officers' footprints on the floor. The officers, as well as the dog unit, had been milling around the house for a while as they investigated the home and the field, so it would have been impossible for someone to not only return to the house, but then to also collect all those items and disappear without a trace. Perhaps the creepiest point of all was the fact that the writing on the wall was still there, seeming to whisper them its one message again and again. The officers left the house and never returned, stating a report that they lost the suspect in the field with no further investigation. What did they stumble onto that night? No one has been able to explain. Soon afterwards, arsonists burned down the farmhouse, and whatever secrets it held, they remain in the ashes. And that's enough for tonight, I think. I do apologize for this kind of being a... I feel like I rushed this. I don't know why I was in such a quick move. What am I trying to say here? I don't fucking know. I apologize. I feel like this is a very rushed episode. Was it meant to be? I was talking very, very fast. I'll definitely work on that for next episode. Speaking of next episode, well, we have one more, and then I'm probably going to do... I think I did this last year on my favorite Godzilla movies and stuff, but I'm going to do... excuse me, Jesus. Something in my throat. What I'm going to do is a Kaiju Christmas. Each episode, I'm going to pick three random Kaiju movies and go into them and review them. But I'm going to do like three obscure random, like not like the usual Godzilla, Gamera, like King Kong stuff that everybody's used to. I'm looking for like three lesser known Kaiju movies that are out there that not many people may have heard of, and kind of want to bring some, you know, if I think they're great, I want to bring some notoriety to them, maybe get more people to see them. If they're not so great, maybe tell people, like, watch this of your own accord, because not everyone likes the same kind of stuff. But anyways, that's what's coming in December, you know, Kaiju Christmas, or very Kaiju, I don't know, I'll come up with a name or whatever for it, but that's what's coming up. I think I talked about this last week, but I did have a Patreon for the show. I'm going to kind of edit it up. I had different tiers, but at this point, I'm just going to do one tier. It's $1. If you're able to donate $1 just to kind of keep the show up and running and maybe help me kind of go towards a laptop and stuff, I'd appreciate it. You don't have to. Don't worry about it. It's just going to be $1, plain and simple. I was going to do the whole different tiers and do all these you know, I just, it's just easier to make it $1. You get access to, you know, just some random thoughts of myself. I'll probably post some TikTok stuff. And then I'll try and do like an advance, release of the show, like a Patreon only stream or, you know, just something for patrons only that, you know, if they want to hear the episode early, they can do that. If not, it's whatever. If they just want to contribute $1 for being nice, that's awesome. I appreciate it. But if not, it's no problem. It's not required, blah, blah, blah. I'm reaching out to a few artists and getting some new logos and stuff that can eventually be turned into, like, stickers and merch. And eventually I will have a laptop and a microphone and a better recording space. So I do apologize because I'm sure it's echoey in here and I'm sure you've heard me tapping the phone like a billion times, just like that. And I apologize. Yeah, I can see even on my wave screen here in my recording, just that tap, just that must be. I apologize for that. I really do. Please forgive me. I was just testing something, sorry. Yeah, I'll be working on some stuff. Yeah. So, I hope you enjoy this. I hope you enjoy the creepy stories, the extreme horror stuff. I didn't really go into too much detail because, number one, going into a lot of it is a lot of spoilers and stuff. And I don't really want to gross you all out with, like, some of the horrible atrocities that are committed to people on these. But anyways, that's a whole another thing. We'll go into some more gross out and horror stuff next week. And, oh my God, I should go to bed. Excuse me. Jesus, Pete. My apologies. And we'll be talking about some more paranormal stuff. And maybe even, we'll talk some more anime stuff next week. Or next episode, sorry. Yeah. So I will end this here. Thank you all for tuning in and listening. And thank you all for being a friend of the podcast, my friend, and for listening. See you soon.